Charlotte.
This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Christmas is a time of hustle and bustle because of all the holiday shopping we engage in. You can blame Charles Dickens, I suppose. It was his story, A Christmas Carol, that set the tone for how we celebrate Christmas today. It was in his story that we witnessed the transformation of Ebenezer Scrooge from someone who constantly replied bah humbug to every utterance of Merry Christmas to someone who celebrated the day with gifts given from the heart. But there is a big difference between a holiday feast bought and paid for by Ebenezer Scrooge for Bob Cratchit, Tiny Tim, and the rest of their family, and the ugly Christmas sweater you'll receive this year from your Aunt Minerva, who lives in Alaska and hasn't seen you since you were 10, or the CD you're planning to give to your teenage son, who hasn't played a CD since he bought himself an iPod 5 years ago. I mean, CDs are so 80s. The point here is that this exercise in gift-giving, which, thanks to Ebenezer Scrooge's transformation, we are led to believe is a good thing, can actually be very frustrating for the giver, and one that is oftentimes unappreciated by the receiver. I mean, what's the good of receiving something you don't want? There's no value in that. And that is the point behind a little book bravely written by our guest this hour. Joel Waldfogel is an economist and the Aaron Krantz Family Professor and Chair of Business and Public Policy at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. He is also the author of Scroogenomics, Why You Shouldn't Buy Presents for the Holidays. And just in time for Christmas, he joins us for the hour. Welcome to the program, Dr. Waldfogel. You're welcome.
Thanks for having me.
I have to ask you about this. Rarely do I get gifts, I mean books, rather, from my producer with little notes on the front of them saying, isn't this the cutest little book you've ever seen? And it is cute. It's a very small stocking stuffer-sized book with a little boy sitting on a Christmas present crying. This is obviously purposeful, but it strikes me as rather ironic. Any comments?
Well, no children were harmed in the taking of that picture, I am assured.
Well, it's obviously meant to look very cute and warm and fuzzy, but the message inside could set people's teeth on edge, it seems to me. I want to ask about the very first thing you say in the book. You say that you first encountered Christmas after your formal indoctrination as an economist.
Yes.
How can that be?
Well, you know, sometimes education works, you know, and sinks in and what you learn in school. But, you know, different families celebrate holidays differently. And I think my first exposure came after I had this educational experience about in which I learned how resources are allocated mm-hmm. and are supposed to be allocated. And then it prompted me, I guess, to look at a lot of things differently, including I noticed holiday gift giving just was not at all in keeping with what I had learned about resource allocation. It got me started thinking about this question.
And as an economist, you call Christmas a large and organized institution for value destruction, which you say is obscured by our warm childhood memories. But shouldn't those memories and the ones we're creating as gift givers and gift receivers override the economics?
Well, yes and no. I mean, so let me talk about the basic idea, then let's get to the question of whether sort of the joy of giving outweighs all this stuff. I mean, normally, I only buy stuff for myself if mm-hmm. I find things that are worth more than the price. So normally, spending does create a reasonable measure of satisfaction. Gift giving is really different. When I set out to spend, say, $50 on you, since I don't know exactly what you like or need, I could spend $50 and buy something that's worth nothing to you. If I did that, then instead of creating at least $50 worth of satisfaction, the spending would create nothing, and in that sense, we'd be missing out. We'd be destroying value. Now, that brings us back to the question of somehow, is the joy of giving, does that somehow justify all this? And you know, here, although I do think the joy of giving is real and important, I don't think it justifies bad giving, because after all, if I got joy both out of giving you something that you do like, mm-hmm. worth more than 50 to you if I spent 50, as well as joy of giving out of giving you something you don't like. Well, if I got the same joy from giving you the better thing, then giving you the better thing would have created a lot more satisfaction. And relative to that, we're missing out. So joy of giving is important, and I think its consequence is that we can't just not give. If we just don't give, we miss out on the joy. But unfortunately, the joy doesn't justify the bad stuff.
I mean, as I read through this book, my eyes were getting wider and wider. It was kind of an eye-opening experience. On the other hand, I recognized me in the book. I recognized others in the book, people that I had given gifts to, and that you look at their faces and you knew that you were batting zero, but they were trying to hide it. And what you say here, I mean, the value of gifts received is well below the money expended to buy them. Did this come as a revelation to you as you went into this? Or as an economist, did you already know this?
I mean, sort of yes and no. I mean, at one level, you know, all of microeconomics is about how individuals are best suited to make choices for themselves. In fact, many economists walk away, or students of economics walk away from those lessons saying, you know, government is terrible because government is a process for choosing stuff that's somebody other than me making my choices. And so sort of the condemnation people have for the process of others making choice for us is really the basis for many economists' disdain for government. Mm-hmm. Yet at the same time, here's this, quote, voluntary process in which others are making choices for us and doing a pretty lousy job, not surprisingly. And no one had, I think, thought to take this one to task or at least question it as an institution for resource allocation.
You say that only about 25%, which is a pretty low figure, 25% of the gifts given and received are what the receivers would have bought for themselves, and the result is that this massive amount of holiday spending does a horrible job with users. Why then do we continue to do it? I mean, this is not. I mean, we,
yeah.
And you say also later in the book, and we just talked about this a little bit, the government, that if we saw the government spending money the way we spend money with the result that this gift-giving and receiving process comes up with, we'd vote them out of office.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, so there are a few points to make. So first of all, this behavior, this gift-giving behavior, it's entirely voluntary, or so we are told. And so I think no one thinks to question it. Although, you know, having said that, I don't think it really is as entirely voluntary as people suppose.
Uh-huh.
I mean, I ask the question, am I free to stiff mom at the holidays? You know, is it okay for me to show up for the big day empty-handed? And of course, there's no law that says I have to bring her something. But I think there is a strong social pressure, what the sociologists would call a norm, that's hard to violate. And if I have no choice but to give something, then we can't use the usual economic logic of inferring from the fact that someone chose something that it was therefore the best possible choice. Mm-hmm. That only works for truly voluntary decisions. But if somebody's doing something under some sort of duress, we can't infer optimality from choice. I mean, having said that, you also raise the interesting question of how could it possibly persist if it's so inefficient? And this is a serious question because normally I think we develop ways to get around problems. I mean, think about wedding registries. You know, when really big dollars are at stake, we don't just let other people choose for us. We turn it into cash by saying, here's exactly what I want. Buy me a place setting. You know, buy me this, buy me that.
Yes.
And we haven't quite done that yet with Christmas, although some people have made moves in that direction. But I do think that a big part of the reason why we don't get better at this is that there really isn't what economists would call sharp incentives or clear feedback for bad choices. We are very much trained, and I think this is proper. You know, we're civilized people, but we're trained to be polite in the face of awful gifts. And again, I don't think we should behave any differently. I think it would be wrong to say, you know, Grandma, I hate this thing, and I don't like you so much either. But I think the fact that we don't do that is what perpetuates the lack of direct feedback is what perpetuates ill-chosen gifts.
Well, I think,
again, we're stuck between a rock and a hard place because I'm surely not advocating being mean to Grandma.
No, of course not. But the bottom line figure here, you give in the book, and I've forgotten what it is now, but it's a massive amount of money that's wasted.
Well, yeah. So the way I do it is, I do these surveys asking people about the gifts they'd received as well as stuff they'd purchased for themselves. And I come, I ask them, what would you be willing to pay for this stuff? What do you think the giver paid? And I come to the conclusion that people value the stuff others give them on average 20% less per dollar spent than the stuff they buy for themselves. Again, this shouldn't be a terrible surprise. Other people choose for us. They don't know what to buy. They buy stuff we wouldn't have been willing to pay, face value for. Multiply that 20% by the volume of holiday spending. Now, the National Retail Federation says we're spending $400 billion a year. I would say a more sensible number is $65 billion on gifts, but whatever. $65 billion times 20%, then is $13 billion in missing satisfaction in the U.S. And by the way, around the world, it's much bigger than that. It's $145 billion. So we have $13 billion missing in U.S. and $25 billion around the world. So anyways, it's kind of like big numbers at the end of the day.
You write about how at Christmas time department stores are jammed with people, but worse, the aisles are jammed with gift items. Now, these are things that none of us, and I know this for a fact, none of us would buy for ourselves. So why do we think, oh, there's a toenail clipper. It looks like a golf club. Dad plays golf. I'll buy him the toenail clipper that looks like. Why would we do this? Or is it just because we're desperate for something that they might like or that would fit with their lifestyle or their hobbies?
I mean, I really do think that those sort of gift kiosks speak to the fact that there is an obligation to give gifts. Now, of course, we sometimes have an organic desire to give a gift, and there's a person we not only love, but we have an idea what to give them. But I think what happens every year is that we, you know, all of a sudden the gun goes off, and we have an obligation to buy gifts for all 20-some of, you know, acquaintances and friends. And it's just very challenging. And I think those islands of stuff are there to meet this obligation. I don't blame the retailers, but I think they do speak to this underlying obligation that we are living under.
And worse, you say, is the fact, and we'll talk more about this later on in the program, but that we do much of this spending with credit, going into hock using money we don't yet have to buy things that recipients don't really want. I thought about this yesterday. Do we do this in any other part of our lives?
Well, I mean, I think we use debt a lot in a lot of consumers.
But for things
want. Look at the recent housing crisis, you know. Yeah. We used a lot of borrowed money to buy houses we couldn't quite afford.
But we wanted them.
Yeah, we did want them.
Yeah.
That's true. I mean, it is interesting, though, because in the 1930s, people saved money prior to Christmas. You know, Christmas, we know it's coming. It comes same day every year. People saved money in what were called Christmas Club accounts. And in some ways, they were sort of terrible financial instruments because they paid low or no interest. But people were putting a little bit of money in every week, and then they take it out in December and buy gifts with it. And fast forward, in the last 30 years, when revolving credit has grown to $1 trillion, with a T, that's a big, really big number. Now what people do is they basically put 2/3 of Christmas on the credit card, and it's mostly not paid off for a couple of months. So it's a very different time pattern.
But you're an economist, and retail establishments depend on this kind of spending. It can mean their success or failure. So what would be the impact on the economy and therefore on our American way of life if we stopped behaving?
That's a good question. So let me talk about it in two parts, because one is the basic question of whether spending is really good for the economy in the first place. And then I think the second question is, what is it that I really want people to do? So, I mean, when we say spending is good, we have in mind the two parties to the transaction. There's a buyer and there's a seller. And in a normal transaction, what the seller gets is a price that exceeds his cost and therefore some profit. And that's a good thing, not just because I'm a Wharton professor, but, you know, it's one of those forms of social surplus that's beneficial. And the buyer also gets some surplus. The buyer gets an item that he values at or above the price. And in particular, let's focus on above the price. And just to make that vivid, you know, think about one of my favorite examples. Think about when your kid's crying with an ear infection. You'd be willing to pay hundreds or thousands of dollars for a cure. The cure comes in the form of amoxicillin or some, you know, antibiotic that costs a few dollars. You know, you get an enormous amount of surplus out of that transaction. But frankly, every voluntary transaction has the buyer obtaining something worth at least as much as the price, and therefore he or she walks away with some surplus. Okay, that's the long-winded way of saying spending is usually good. Now think about gift spending, a little bit different. Seller still gets his profit, but now the buyer doesn't get something worth more than the price.
We have to take a break. Joel Waldfogel is our guest. The name of his book that we're talking about is Scroogenomics, Why You Shouldn't Buy Presents for the Holidays. May have come too late for you this year, but you can file that information away for next. And we'll come right back in a moment. Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
And you're listening to Charlotte Talks. This is a rebroadcast of Charlotte Talks here on 90.7 WFAE, listener-supported public radio. Wynton Marsalis joins us for a thought-provoking, surprising conversation about music, arts, and life. Plus, we enjoy a cup of Christmas tea. That's when Charlotte Talks, tomorrow morning at 9 on 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. Support this hour comes from WFAE members and Tyndall Subaru Gastonia, the new Subaru 2015 Legacy with Subaru EyeSight Driver Assist Technology, the Subaru Share the Love event through January 2nd. Details at TyndallSubaru.com. Showers and possibly a thunderstorm today in Charlotte, patchy fog, a high around 64 degrees tonight. Again, showers and thunderstorms and a low expected around 44 degrees. It's 47.
On the next Diane Rehm Show, in the 1960s, Peter, Paul, and Mary helped bring folk music into the mainstream. They gave voice to the political struggles of a generation and continued to collaborate for decades. Members of the group on 50 years of music and life.
Join us for the Diane Rehm Show at 10 here on 90.7 WFAE, listener-supported public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins, and we're talking to Dr. Joel Waldfogel, who is a professor of economics and other things, actually chair of business and public policy at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. His book is called Scroogenomics, Why You Shouldn't Buy Presents for the Holidays, and he joins us from the studios at the Wharton School. Prior to the recession, we kept being told on this program by economists that 70% of our economy was based on consumer spending. Am I hearing you say that spending isn't good?
Well, spending normally is good in the sense that spending normally produces these forms of surplus for both buyer and seller. People get stuff worth the amount that they spend, and sellers get some profit. You know, again, the problem is just when other people are choosing for us, sellers still get their profit, but people don't get stuff that's worth nearly as much as spending ought to create satisfaction.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the recapping, what you've alluded to several times in the last segment, is that gift recipients would generally pay less for the item they are given than the gift giver actually paid. So if someone gives me a sweater that they paid $100 for, I might say that I've been willing to pay maybe $80 or $70 for it, or even nothing. If I hate it. But as the recipient, I got it for free. So isn't there some value in that?
Well, I mean, of course there is. But if we think about the giver as a person too, we have to think about what did they pay in addition to what did we get, and kind of as a unit. You know, if you're happy in your family for somebody to spend $100 to get you $80 worth of value, that's just like the opposite of a money pump, right? It's just destroying value.
But what about
certainly as recipients, you know, we get benefit out of receiving anything. Mm-hmm. But if it costs somebody more than the benefit that's achieved for us, then on net we're losing.
And this is maybe a calculation that's even impossible for the highest supercomputer to do. But what about changing one's mind over time? I know that I've gotten gifts that at first blush I did not like, I did not appreciate, I had no intention, for instance, if it was a shirt or a sweater, of ever wearing it. And one day I walked into the closet and realized, oh gosh, everything is wrinkled, I got nothing to wear, I'll wear that, which I've never, and I put it on and I wear it out and people go, wow, that's great, where did you get that? I've never seen you wear that before, wow. And then suddenly you think, well, this is not so bad after all. And you wear it a lot after that because people have commented on – you've changed your mind on it. Now, there's no way to calculate that, is there?
Well, so I'm very sympathetic to that. One of the things gift givers can do when gift giving is really firing on all cylinders, mm-hmm. what a gift is, it's something we would not have chosen ourselves, but is in fact better than what we would have chosen ourselves.
Yeah.
And it's because they know us so well and they know a lot about appropriate clothing or neat music or wonderful books, and they actually buy something for us we wouldn't have chosen for ourselves. And that does actually happen. You know, in my data, I see lots of gifts where it's worth more to the recipient than what they would have purchased for themselves. Mm-hmm. It's just that it's hard. On average, it doesn't happen. It sometimes does. It's most likely to happen if the giver is someone who's in pretty frequent contact with the recipient. You know, I should say that there's that average value destruction of 20%, but it varies a lot across giver-recipient relationships. People in frequent contact, significant others do the best, friends do pretty well, even parents do quite well for their own children. But people in less frequent contact on average do a lot worse, and they're much less likely to come up with those what I would call transcendent gifts, the things you wouldn't have chosen, but are better, in fact, than what you would have chosen.
But, you know, Christmas is this warm and fuzzy season that has holiday music. It's the only season of the year that has its own soundtrack. It's got its own music. It's got its own we decorate everything to look different because it's Christmas. And so it gives us these warm fuzzies, and more important, we are conditioned by this whole season. We're supposed to like giving gifts because it's an expression of caring. But you say, and this is where it gets back into the sticky wicket again, you say that we shouldn't attach much value to the sentiment that accompanies a gift given, because that would imply that there was sentiment being experienced by the gift giver, And that's not always the case.
Well, I don't discount the sentiment. I think that the sentiment, both for the giver and the recipient, could be important. And that's why I don't think the answer is simply not to give. The question, though, is could the sentiment, either the joy on the giver side or the sentimental value of having been given something on the recipient side, could that also have come through with an item you actually wanted? And if so, then bad gifts are missing out on something. Mm-hmm. But not giving loses out on, unfortunately, both the sentimental value on the recipient side and the joy of giving on the giver side. So that's not probably a solution for most people.
So this leads us to the million-dollar question, and I'm going to let one of our callers ask it because they have read my mind. Frank in Huntersville, go ahead.
I agree totally with the professor, and as a result, I give the absolute perfect gift. It never has to be returned, and it always fits. And some people may not like this, but I give cash.
So it's not a question, it's a statement, but I was going to ask, is cash the way to go here?
Well, you know, so there's a lot to recommend cash. I mean, because cash allows the recipient to choose what he or she wants. So in that sense, it's not a clunker. It's not going to beat what...
That's okay.
What the recipient would have chosen. Mm-hmm. But the only problem with cash for some people, many people find it an awkward gift. So I'm not condemning it, but at the same time, I can't suggest that everyone ought to give it because psychologists have studied this, and in our culture, many people find cash to be an awkward gift. And so as I respect the choice to do it for people who find that comfortable, but I also understand it doesn't work for everyone.
So are there best or better candidates to give cash to than others? I guess you wouldn't give it to your office mate, but you might give it to what, your teenage son or daughter?
I do think we see cash is more acceptable going from elders to youngers. So we see cash going from grandparents to grandchildren. Mm-hmm. We see cash going from aunts and uncles to nieces and nephews. And interestingly enough, these are cash is most common in precisely the situations where a non-cash choice, a particular item, would be most likely to not go over well. So it's like cash is a choice that's made to avoid destroying value.
But if we all engaged in this cash swap at holiday time, first of all, the government would start to get involved in this. I'm certain of that. Somebody would come out on the short end of the stick. Somebody would be giving more cash away than they received.
That's true. I mean, some cultures
therefore a destruction
have a lot of cash
in value.
Giving. No, it's just a transfer. Like if I give you 100 and you give me 50, one of us is sore, but no money, nothing got destroyed. But again, I'm not advocating this. I mean, in some cultures, this is actually quite common. In China, this is a very common practice, cash giving in these red envelopes. But I don't think I can just say that's what we ought to do. I mean, I think the caller has worked something out that works fine in his family, and that's great. But I know that over the years, I've pointed out this is the theoretically mm-hmm. superior solution, but I've learned that many people don't find this one comfortable. It doesn't accomplish all of their goals from giving, so we have to think about other solutions.
Back before the internet, I suppose it was more difficult to find out what people paid for things. So you could get a sweater that you think, well, that's not a very nice guy. I don't like that at all. But the giver could have paid $300 for it. There was no way for you to tell. Now that we've come into the internet age, and brands, which pretty much are the same price in every store that they're sold in, we know what the value of the present was. So unless you bought it on some super sale, is it more acceptable now to give cash or to give gift cards because we know the dollar value of things?
Well, I suspect, I mean, in the last 15 years, we've had enormous growth in gift cards, and I think, and also a very big growth in gift receipts, which kind of turned the sweater into a gift card of sorts. I mean, you have to walk it back to the store, but if you have the gift receipt, you can get whatever you want with it. And it is interesting, these gift cards were maybe a blip 15 years ago, and now they're a third of holiday gift giving and maybe $80 billion across the entire year. They're like cash in that they let the recipient choose what he or she wants, but they seem to avoid the stigma. I mean, they appear at the top of these most wanted gift lists, so they're an interesting development. They do have one problem, though, that I want to highlight. About 10% of their value never gets redeemed. And that's not waste. It's just a transfer over to the retailer, or in some states, a transfer to the state government. But it's probably not what the giver had in mind when he bought a gift card for his loved one. So I would really love to see a new kind of gift card where, say, after 24 months, the unspent value just went straight to charity.
Wow. But there are also charity gift cards, aren't there? You can you not... just yes, give no, there to are.
That's,
and
that's yeah. another thing that I would love to. So you know, short of cash, you know, gift cards let the recipient choose. But there's another thing we can do, and it's a growing trend, quite apart from my suggestion, is giving gifts to charity in the name of our recipients. And one of the really convenient ways to do this is through what's called a charity gift card. You can get these from like tisbest.org or Charity Navigator. Mm-hmm. And a charity gift card, you know, you pay, say, $100 for this thing, and then your recipient has a card. He can go to the website and choose from a long list of charities which one gets the money. Now, what you know, there's a soft-hearted, I think, an obvious soft-hearted rationale for these, but there's a hard-headed one, too. One of the things we try to accomplish with gift-giving is to let our recipients experience a luxury that they can't normally afford. And, you know, we usually think about that as chocolate or something like that. But one of the clearest luxuries in the U.S. spending data is actually cash gifts to charity. So if I give you a charity gift card, I'm letting you act like a rich guy and enjoy the luxury of charitable giving. Mm. And, you know, nothing useless had to get made, right? So elves have to work to make stuff. But no elves had to work to make this thing. And we both get to feel good about doing something useful. So I like that idea a lot.
So if all the gifts that we're talking about that we don't want are value destroying in some way, is there any such thing as a value creating gift?
Well, no, I do think that sometimes people do make these choices that are better than what we would have chosen for ourselves. I mean, I have to admit, the only neckties I ever get complimented on are those that were given as gifts by my wife. So, you know, score one for gift giving. But she knows me pretty well. She's in a very good spot to give. And so, in fact, my biggest suggestion, notwithstanding the whole Scrooge thing, is go ahead and keep on giving in those situations where you have some idea what somebody wants, as well as, you know, a desire to do something. You know very well what your children want. They're probably hinting all year. You know very well what your wife or husband wants. You know, if you're talking and listening all year, as I'm sure most husbands are, you have a very good idea what to do. So go ahead and give in those situations. But just be aware that when you don't have any idea, you really are at risk. And I don't think this is a surprise to anyone, but it's just that when you tally it up and realize we're spending $65 billion, you know, we ought to be getting something useful out of that. You know, because it's a lot of money. And so realize that a choice to shoot in the dark is probably a choice that's going to miss the mark.
So let me share some comments that we're getting on Facebook and email and other means of communication here today. Will on Facebook writes, don't we see this story every year? You can spend the money no better than the receiver of the gift would, so you might as well just give them cash because you most likely will buy them something that they value less than you paid, so you lost value. Okay, great. But what about it's the thought that counts? It creates a stronger bond between people. Even if the gift is only 80% right, surely the better relationship compensates for 20% loss of consumer welfare. I suppose the sticky point is that there has to be some thought in the gift as opposed to buying somebody crap that's on sale. His words, not mine.
Mm-hmm. I mean, so I hear that a lot. But again, the question is, could I have communicated that thought that counts with a better gift, or does that thought only go with the bad gift? And if the thought only goes with the thing the recipient doesn't want, well, then we're stuck and we have a problem. But then I would say givers are sadists, and I don't think that that's right. So, no, the thought that counts is the same as the joy of giving or the sentimental value of receiving. And it's all real. It's all important. But the question is, can we accomplish those additional objectives of gift giving also with things that recipients want? If so, then we have a problem that could be solved with better resource allocation choices. If not, we have sort of a pathological set of traditions.
Joel Waldfogel is our guest. He's a professor and chair of the Business and Public Policy Department at Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. And his book is called Scroogenomics, Why You Shouldn't Buy Presents for the Holidays. Ryan in Charlotte emails, and we've talked a little bit about gift cards and where you stand on gift certificates and gift cards in your thesis here, but what about ignoring the fees that may be associated with holding a balance on that card over time? Wouldn't I get more value for that money because I'm giving it away and the user gets the added value? Is that more in line with a charitable donation, even though the motivation and evaluation satisfaction is slightly different? I'm not sure I understand the question, but there's the question.
I'm not sure I do either, but okay. But it does raise an interesting point. You know, there are at least two kinds of gift cards. There are the retailer issued gift cards, most of which have no expiration dates mm-hmm. and no fees. That said, there still is non-redemption because people are human and they lose them. Then there are the bank issued gift cards, which tend to have explicit fees. And although they have the advantage of being redeemable at a variety of stores, they have a huge disadvantage of having giant fees. you know, people should do with that information what they will. But both kinds have some challenges.
Alan in Charlotte writes, "The show today brings to mind an experience I had just this week while shopping for my wife. She needs a new wallet, and she expressed interest in one particular brand. A basic bifold wallet from this maker is an average of $175. I cannot possibly justify spending this much money on a wallet. I found a perfectly good wallet for less than half that price, which is still too much, and I bought it. And I very frankly told my wife later that I could not, in good conscience, spend that much money on such an item and that she could take my gift and return it if she wanted to buy the other brand. I feel that it's important to be extremely frank about what you want to buy, what you want in a gift, but also what you are willing to do for the other person. Between adults, it seems that we could avoid a lot of negative response we can sometimes have during the gift-giving process. Your thoughts?"
Well, you know, that's interesting. It's a kind of a negative example of something that I talk about in the book as a method for doing transcendent giving, meaning giving that's better than what I would have done for myself. I think inside of families, one of the things we can sometimes do for each other is to give permission. In this case, I think he didn't want to give permission for that particular bit of extravagance. But I know in my own family, you know, I don't feel that I have the right to just go spend our money. I have kids and a wife. And so once in a while, my wife says, you know, why don't you just go ahead and get that piece of electronics you've been you know, staring at for months and months. You have my permission to do so. And that's a fantastic gift, frankly. I mean, after all, it's all our money. You know, so she can't really give me money, but she can say, you know, that's a sanctioned or approved decision. Go ahead and do it. Mm-hmm. In the wallet example, I guess it didn't work.
It's the reverse. You can't buy that wallet. And finally, right. Walton Statesville says, "My mother buys her grandchildren a new set of pajamas every Christmas. Last year, my 4-year-old son tore into the package, saw that it contained pajamas instead of a toy, and nearly cried. He put his head in his hands and then laid his head on the table. We all got a good laugh out of his reaction, actually, but I was left with trying to make sure he understands that not all gifts will be the kind he thinks he should get. What sort of lessons should we be teaching our children about gift giving, and how early should we start?"
Well, this is so interesting. I mean, I think at that age, especially I'm, as a dad, I guess I'll say this, I think we know better than they do what they ought to have, frankly. You know, if you said to a young kid, "What do you want?" he might say, "I'd like 10 pounds of candy corn." And frankly, I wouldn't feel that good about giving it to him. I'd rather give him a nice, warm pair of pajamas. So in that case, it's I don't think we want to, you know, kind of fully respect his preferences because he's a kid after all. We have the job to take care of him. You know, at some point, it becomes harder and harder sometime around the teenage years and beyond, whether we want to or not. I think we're forced to begin respecting their pretty well-defined preferences.
I'm just curious that you write about this in Slate. You write for Slate. You've written this book now. What kind of an impact do you think your writing on this topic will have, or what would you wish it would have?
Oh, in my dreams, we would literally move $1 billion from waste over to good causes.
Okay. We're going to come back in a second here and talk more with Joel Waldfogel about his book, Scroogenomics, and the thesis in it, Why You Shouldn't Buy Presents for the Holidays. Stay with the Charlotte Talks on WFAE.
Glad to have you with us this morning. This is a rebroadcast of Charlotte Talks here at 90.7 WFAE, your source for in-depth news. Coming up in 20 minutes on the Diane Rehm Show in the early 1960s, Peter, Paul, and Mary helped bring folk music out of the coffee houses and onto the airwaves. Their songs of protest and struggle helped define a generation. In a new book, they look back on a career that spanned 5 decades. That's Diane Rehm at 10 o'clock. And support for our programming comes from WFAE members and the law firm Horak Tally, helping individuals and businesses find sharp solutions to their legal needs for more than 80 years. Details at horaktally.com. Rain in the forecast today in Charlotte, patchy fog and a high near 64 degrees today. It's 47.
What can we look forward to next year? How about more internet everywhere and more ways for advertisers to find us?
We're going to be connected and more effectively connected, not just by our cell connection, but by Wi-Fi all the time.
I'm Adrienne Hill. The internet, ads, and everyday life. Next time on Marketplace from 8 p.m.
Marketplace at 6:30 here on 90.7 WFAE, listener-funded public radio.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. Joel Waldfogel is our guest today at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania, and his book is called Scroogenomics, Why You Shouldn't Buy Presents for the Holidays. And I want to point out that this is not an attack on Christmas on your part. It is an argument for efficient gift giving. So is the only way to do that through the use of cash?
Well, you know, I think we do pretty well making choices for people we know pretty well. So I think there it's always a little bit of a crapshoot, but it's a pretty good odds crapshoot with the people we know well. And so I would say in my own practice is to continue giving gifts to those I know well.
Mm-hmm.
But for others, I think we do need to think about alternatives. And cash only really is the solution in principle. Some people like that, but many people find it uncomfortable. So that's why I like the gift cards and the charity gift cards.
This is almost a worldwide phenomenon, and you alluded a few minutes ago to the wasted money worldwide, the value of it, this uptick in spending at Christmas time. But in fact, and this is going to surprise some people because it sure surprised me, because we think of ourselves in the United States as being numero uno at everything. including a wasteful spending at Christmas time. But we, in fact, rank 12th in the list. Norway, the UK, Italy, Finland, and France constitute the top five in per capita Christmas spending. How can that be?
I was surprised, I have to admit. You know, I got my hands on the OECD monthly spending data for a lot of countries. And you know, there is this big December spike in spending, certainly in the U.S. You know, sort of the retail sales jump around a little bit, but then in December they fly way up mm-hmm. and then come way back down in January. And it turns out you see that in many, many countries. The only places you don't see that among the countries I looked at were Korea, China, and Israel. And it's mainly because they're not celebrating their gift-giving holidays in December. You know, in Israel, they don't give gifts at Hanukkah the way American Jews do. They give gifts at New Year's in the fall and Passover in the spring. In any event, not only do we see this spending spike virtually everywhere, but ours is not nearly the biggest. You know, you mentioned the per capita spending measure, which is another way to do this. We're about 12th on that one. But in terms of this December spending spike, we're actually about 20th on a list of major economies. And it's been that way for 40 years. So it's not, you know, I was surprised.
So is the same true in these other countries, that all this gift giving is diminishing value everywhere?
I have done a few surveys around the world, and I find very similar kinds of results. Actually, somebody after my original study 15 years ago did a study in India of Diwali. So Diwali has now emerged as a gift-giving holiday, and they found the same kind of results there too. So it's not specific to Christmas. It's not specific to Christians. It's just about gift-giving holidays where other people are making our choices for us. It's just unfortunately not a very good way, to use jargon, to allocate resources.
I don't know how much research you've done in terms of historical research going back years and years and years, but how has our spending on Christmas changed over the years? Is there any way to measure how our great grandmothers and great grandfathers bought during the early parts of the 20th century versus how we do it today?
Well, the U.S. government does keep interesting statistics going back a long ways, and so the retail monthly retail sales statistics, roughly in their current form, go all the way back to 1935, and sure enough, you see this December spending spike every year since 1935 up to the present. And one thing you can do is you can ask, well, how big is this spending spike relative to the whole size of the economy? And actually, since 1935, the economy's grown by about a factor of 5, whereas holiday spending's only grown by about a factor of 3, which is a way of saying that it was a bigger deal in 1935 relative to the economy than it is today.
So we're spending less? We're spending less today?
Well, we're spending more. But put it this way, we're a lot richer, and we're only spending a little bit more.
So the portion of our income that goes toward Christmas spending is less than it was in the Great Depression.
Exactly.
Wow.
Yeah. And not just in the particular depressed period of the Depression, even in the surrounding years when we were flush with money. So it wasn't just the cyclical downturn in spending. Another way to think about this is, like, when we get really rich, do we spend only a little bit more or a lot more on Christmas? And this gets to the economic definition of a luxury. A luxury is something, you know, where as we get richer, we spend a higher share of our income on it. As I mentioned, charitable giving is that sort of luxury. Mm-hmm. But holiday giving is not. Over time, again, income's gone up by a factor of 5 and spending's only gone up by a factor of 3. So that means the share of our expenditure has gone down. And in contemporary, if you look across households today, you have to see the same thing. Richer families spend a bit more on Christmas, but nowhere near as much more proportionally as they are richer. So that makes it a necessity like gasoline as opposed to a luxury like caviar.
I'm going to go to the phones in a second, but I'm going to misquote you before I do here because you say that every generation thinks that they are the first to discover what? Sex and excessive spending?
Yes.
But you also quote somebody that I did take the time to write the quote down, and I think this will also fascinate people. Here's the quote. There are worlds of money wasted at this time of year in getting things that nobody wants and nobody cares for after they are got. Who said that?
Is this question for me?
Yeah.
Harriet Beecher Stowe.
In 1850.
1850, yeah. Either very prescient, I guess, or maybe this thing's been going on for a while.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's been going on for a lot longer than most Christmas legends and traditions that we've entered in, that have entered the popular culture, because a lot of the way we celebrate Christmas today originated in Victorian times in the 1850s. So evidently she was responding to this new way of celebrating Christmas, which has not changed much over time. Let's take some calls here. Debbie in Concord, welcome to the program.
Hello, enjoying your program. Two different friends of ours are changing gifts this year in honor of each other. And our one club, instead of buying for each other, we decided to adopt a family, a mother and 3 children, and then we each divided up and got to go shopping for the children and with their list. So we're buying something we know the children want, and we're doing it anonymously, and I think we got as much out of that as buying the, you know, $10 gift to you don't think anybody will even like. Then another family, she lives out of state. We decided she would give something in my honor and I in her honor, and I'm giving to buying a Guidepost magazine for a soldier because I know she enjoys the military, and her husband's in golfing, and we're giving to a golf course that has disabled veterans on the golf course. So even though they're all anonymous gifts, we won't see anybody open it and see their faces, I feel much better of the money I'm spending that someone else will enjoy the gift.
I think that's very commendable, but I have to ask our guest, is there a possibility of value destruction in these gifts?
Well, it strikes me as pretty low probability because these are, you know, if you take money and give it to good causes or, you know, sort of needy people or good causes, you know, compare that to giving something to somebody who doesn't want something. I mean, giving one of those items at the, you know, in the middle of the aisles at the mall that nobody needs. I mean, this just seems like a much higher return investment, and it just sounds wonderful to me. I don't mean to impose my values on anybody, but it just sounds like a really high return activity. So I like this idea.
Okay. Debbie, thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Let me go to Carol in Charlotte. Welcome, Carol. You're on WFAE.
Well, good morning.
And your dog is too.
Very loud. Jacques, that's enough. No worries. Sorry about that. I forgot. I really enjoyed listening to your program. And I'd like to say up front, I'm a very giving person. I do give to charities. But with my son, over the years, I've had a problem. He's an adult. And he's married, and I would give him really nice gifts, and then I would get nonsense back. One time, you know, he sent me for Mother's Day a book, and he didn't even mail it himself. It was, you know, like from Amazon.com or something. And the receipt was in it, and I saw that he paid $2 for the book. So a couple of years ago, I just told him, you know, we're not exchanging gifts anymore. And, you know, he was very upset about it, but I just, you know, I had explained to him, you know, this just, actually, I'd had this conversation with him before, that it just wasn't fair. And so we stopped exchanging Christmas presents. And my daughter-in-law, she really likes exchanging gifts. And but what she did to bridge the problem is we just now give gifts for other occasions. So I, instead of giving them a Christmas gift, I'm going to be giving them an anniversary gift in January, and then I get a Mother's Day gift, and she's in charge of it. But it was ridiculous that, you know, a $2 gift, and I would send them, you know, maybe a $100 coat.
Are we keeping score, Joel?
I do hear about that. I don't directly know much about it except anecdotally, but I think there is a sense in which giving begets an obligation to reciprocate, and there are certain expectations all around. It is a season of a complex season of potential disappointment.
Mm, yeah. Thank you for your call, Carol. I appreciate it. And sorry about the $2 book.
Bye-bye.
Craig on Facebook has a similar comment. Now that my brother and I have grown up and left the house, my father has adopted a mantra of the best gift you can give me is to not ask me to go to the mall and buy you a present. And he also returns the favor. Now that the kids across the family have grown up, his approach has caught on. I tell everyone about it as well because it reduces holiday stresses on everybody and makes family gatherings more enjoyable. I would think you'd like that. Andrew writes on our website, how do you factor in givers who have better or less expensive access to things the receiver would want, just not at the going street rate, even if available on the street, i.e., a red carpet ticket from Will Smith or a retail gift bought from with an employee discount? I'm not sure I understand this question either. But in other words, if you work at, say, the Performing Arts Center in town and you get free tickets to things, and so you give somebody a free ticket to Spring Awakening, is that a good thing? Didn't cost you anything.
Yeah, I mean, if it literally didn't cost. So. Yeah, this is going to get technical in a second. But, I mean, if it literally didn't cost anyone anything, it's not just whether I paid, but if it's something that would have been of value to somebody and I give it to somebody who values it less, I've sort of wasted something. On the other hand, if it was a seat that was going to be empty and they weren't going to sell it, it was really worth nothing to nobody, and I gave it to somebody who valued it at all, then, of course, that's going to leave someone better off.
Yeah.
That's going to be efficient, quote, efficient.
You say there's a resistance to cash, although it's diminishing. Henry writes, is part of the solution to find better ways to give cash? For example, my sister had to replace the transmission in her car last week. For Christmas, I'm giving her a $100 bill taped to the back of a bottle of transmission fluid.
That's really a sweet idea. I mean, there's a real need that had to get filled, and it was probably a hole in the budget right at the worst time of the year. And that's probably a way to give cash that is thoughtful. So I think that's probably great.
Here's something we haven't talked about, and you do talk about it in your book, and that is our tendency to buy on credit. This is something that's unlike previous generations because they laid away or they had the Christmas Club where they saved up for Christmas. So given interest rates on credit cards today, that further erodes value, doesn't it?
Well, it does seem like an odd thing to do. You know, again, Christmas is fully anticipated. It's always on December 25th. And so it's just hard to imagine why one would have to borrow for it as opposed to save for it. I mean, this is, I guess, me as a scold as opposed to me as an economist. Because after all, in principle, credit is good because credit simply expands the set of things you could conceivably buy. But having said that, I think many people do abuse credit, and I find it strange. You know, if you look at when payday lending, so payday lending is one of the kind of least favorable forms of borrowing. People essentially pay hundreds and hundreds of percent in interest. And, you know, when does that activity peak? Well, right after Christmas. So I get the sense that there's some economic distress that pushes people into borrowing that's somehow caused by this need to buy stuff.
Is borrowing, from an economist's point of view, is borrowing sometimes good?
Well, I think it's certainly sometimes good. Take, for example, if you want to buy a house, if you waited till you had all the money before you bought the house, you'd be, you know, ready to retire before you could. Mm. But, of course, there you're borrowing to buy this fixed asset that, in principle, ought to maintain its value. So it's pretty safe to lend, he said, right after the housing crisis. Right? If at least you put 20% down, the thing shouldn't drop in value more than 20%.
Right.
You know, so for durable goods like houses and cars, I think borrowing can make a lot of sense. For, you know, Christmas gifts, which aren't durable and they don't come as a surprise, the need to buy them, borrowing seems less easily justified.
Given the recession and the anecdotal stories we're hearing about people changing their views on spending and how they should spend their money, do you think we'll see the return to Christmas clubs where people saved up ahead of time for Christmas, or even the layaway plans that stores used to offer people?
I think we have seen them come back. We saw them begin to disappear not long ago, but I think they have come back. I think it's probably more of a recession phenomenon than a long-term phenomenon, although we'll see. Maybe habits will change.
I love the title of Chapter 10, and I think we need to get an answer to the question here, because the title is Christmas and Commercialism. Are Santa and Jesus on the same team? And if so, who's the team captain?
You know, I'm not sure I have the answer, but I can tell you. I mean, I try to put my own criticism of holiday spending in the context of two, I think, common criticisms. And one is simply the point that we're just too commercial, too much spending. So this is not quite my point, although it's very related. I mean, some people just see the volume of spending and say, you know, this is out of control. It's crazy. This is distracting us from the true meaning of the holiday. And so I think environmentalists have this view. A lot of people of faith have this view. And it's pretty close to my criticism, although mine is more, hey, if we're going to spend, let's at least get something useful and satisfying out of it. But there's this other criticism that says, no, I don't care. Spending's fine. The problem is that essentially that we've banished Jesus from the mall. So these are the people who want to boycott stores that bid their shoppers happy holidays mm-hmm. instead of Merry Christmas. Mm-hmm. So these are that's a rather different criticism of the commercial aspect of Christmas than mine.
You know, as people listen to this conversation and maybe agree with what you're saying here and would like to find a way around the egregious spending they've been involved in and the loss of value they've participated in, perhaps if they don't want to give cash for Christmas, they could all go out and buy your book and give your book as gifts to the people.
Well, as much as that would benefit me, I only want them to do that for people who might actually enjoy it. You know, but of course, they can always buy it for themselves.
I'm just saying that you could give this book out, and maybe people would understand, hey, I should change my habits. Is this book available at most bookstores? I don't know the answer to that.
I think it's at the major bookstores okay. as well as Amazon, Barnes & Noble, stuff like
it's
that.
It's called Scroogenomics, Why You Shouldn't Buy Presents for the Holidays by our guest today, Joel Waldfogel, who joins us from the Wharton School of, Business at the University of Pennsylvania, where he is the Aaron Krantz Chair and Business and Public Policy Professor there. Final question, very quickly. Do you follow your own advice?
I sure do.
Okay.
I buy a lot of gifts for the people that I know well.
All right. Thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Charlotte talks with my